Welcome back to Decouple. Today I'm joined by returning guest, Nick Turan. Nick, it's been far too long. I think you were on a couple of years ago. You're, of course, the great mind behind What is Nuclear. It's been a huge on-ramp for many people in this community. So it's great having you back, man.
Yeah, thanks. So happy to be here. I've been really enjoying, you know, what you've done with the show. And it's just, yeah, great honor to be back. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I understand we kind of narrowly missed each other in COP. It's too bad you couldn't make it out, but
a lot of FOMO.
yeah,
it was fun.
It certainly I got thrust into some sort of uncomfortable situations, just in terms of, you know, moderating panels that I felt radically underqualified to be on, but it really forced me to kind of level up, and I realized, you know, just how grateful I am for the community of kind of technical advisors and sort of, you know, nuclear consultants I can rely on. So it was a really big growing experience for me. There are a couple of themes though that sort of came up for me really broadly in terms of the event and the gathering and the state of nuclear and sort of where things are headed right now. And you know, I guess I've brought this up a few times, but Ernie Moniz and his organizations, the EFI, I forget what it stands for, the NTI, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, Clean Air Task Force, they produced this document called the Nuclear Playbook. And it's a sort of guide for embarking countries on how to go about what are the best practices to build a nuclear program. And beyond it sort of being, I mean, I think ENAC consulted on it, Emirates consulted on it. But, you know, I have like this sort of undertone of anti-Americanism, you know, courtesy of my father. And, you know, I don't know. We're United Empire loyalists. Like my family, we used to be American, and then we, you know, took the wrong side and sided with like King George. And anyway, so there's a old bitter resentment there. Anyway, it feels a little bit of anti-Americanism. I won't dwell on it too much, but it was interesting. And in any case, I mean, most of the discourse that I see in the US right now around nuclear these last, you know, 10 years, there's a little bit of talk about Vogel, but mostly that's sort of swept under the rug. And a lot of talk about advanced nuclear, next generation nuclear, and innovation. And certainly the US is Canada as well, I guess, you know, in terms of the pressurized heavy water reactor, but the US is sort of the home turf of the widely deployed conventional nuclear reactors that make up essentially almost the entire operating fleet around the world, the mighty PWR and BWR. And so I can tell there's a lot of pride still in, you know, we may not be deploying, but we have the best technology in the world. And certainly that's sort of the line I've heard from Jigarshaw and others. So given all that and the focus on, you know, advanced reactors, it was really interesting that this document written by a number of American nonprofits and think tanks was telling embarking nations to be super technologically conservative. Basically, Cole's notes were, you know, choose a design that's in operation with a proven track record. Sounds pretty sensible. You know, almost by definition, that's going to be, you know, low enriched uranium, probably a PWR, probably a once through fuel cycle, so we can avoid any of the messiness around any proliferation risks. So it's very conservative advice. And in my discussion with Ernie Moniz, I said, well, you know, why don't you follow your own advice, kind of thing, in terms of, you know, established embarking nations. And in many ways, the U.S. is a re-embarking nation, despite its massive nuclear fleet it's been struggling to deploy. Anyway, so all that made me come back to this question of innovation, because obviously, you know, we need more than just electricity. We need process heat. We need, you know, we need to replace a variety of fossil fuel services. There's obviously use cases for, again, process heat and other things in nuclear. In the early days of nuclear, there was just, I was just reminding myself of some dates, like the first human-induced fission with like Lise Meitner and Otto Hahn, like 1938, the Fermi pile, the first, you know, controlled chain reaction 42. And then we like jump into having a freaking nuclear-powered submarine like 10 years later. And I think Nautilus is like 52. And we have a commercial nuclear plant in 56, right? Like 14 years from the Fermi pile, we're, you know, splitting atoms in a controlled enough fashion to put electricity on the grid. Like that is an extraordinary set of innovations that occurred. And so I'm wanting to sort of use you, use your kind of encyclopedic mind, your obsessive focus on nuclear for I don't know how many years, to try and better understand that kind of environment of innovation, what it looked like, what the institutions were, what the institutional ecosystems were, to sort of give us some insights into innovation in the 21st century now. So that is a, you know, very verbose intro, and I'm not sure where I kind of give you the on ramp to jump in there, but
well, yeah, no, I mean,
I've lifted the gates.
Great great topic. Very happy to talk about it. I mean, as you know, I spend a lot of hobby time poring over the archives, if you will, and trying to understand those exact questions. How exactly did we do this in the past? What went on? And, you know, who were the personalities? What were they like? And you know, knowing or studying history is valuable in the sense that there's lots to learn in there. And you can hopefully glean some advice for the future. Of course, context changes as well. So things in the history in the past don't necessarily apply as much now, but still I find it extremely valuable. And the more I've dug in, the more I've just been absolutely amazed at what was done and what was documented and how many just hundreds of thousands of pages and hundreds of thousands of people were working on these problems and putting forth ideas and stepping through them, finding where problems were, coming back, iterating. It's like looking into a huge world of something that we're trying to replicate. And so I'm always looking in there looking for interesting ideas and so on. So I'm absolutely happy to talk about it.
There's the famous sort of great man theory of history, and we can certainly, and I think we will touch upon Groves with the Manhattan Project, or Rickover with the Nautilus and shipping port, or, you know, I'm not sure what else. And obviously those are important personalities. But also again, what were the kind of innovation environments like? Like, you know, there's no doubt that America is still kind of number one when it comes to software innovation and tech innovation. I think that's still a truism. Certainly there's rising competition all the time, and there's a dynamism and competitiveness and innovation landscape, which is, you know, thriving out in Silicon Valley. But it seems like we're not making much progress when it comes to innovating in advanced nuclear, I guess, outside of the, you know, like the simulations and the computer work, essentially. We're just not building and deploying.
Yeah, we've built up a pretty tough environment to build and deploy. I mean, yes, the deployment rate right now is dismal. The total amount of electricity in the world, or power or energy in general made by nuclear, is somewhat pathetic. I mean, it's 5% or something like that of total world energy. It's very far from what we had hoped originally that the energy source would be capable of. And now we've sort of plateaued, and we're seeing good things here and there. But how exactly do we get back onto that growth rate that's going to have a significant impact on decarbonizing, providing world energy, and so on, is something we really need to be seriously looking at. And right, there's definitely a common statement in the West or in the United States where it's like, okay, the existing reactors are old. Those are your parents' reactors or your grandparents' reactors, and they have problems and they have a bunch of baggage. But if you look over here, there's all these new types of reactors, innovative reactors, where we finally went ahead and tried to focus on the economics of the system. And so we're bringing it forward in a way that, for the first time, focuses on economics. And that attitude sort of irks me to a degree, in the sense that, I mean, since you can find, again, tens of thousands of pages from 1944 on where they're saying we need to focus for the first time on the economics in order to have an economically competitive power source. I mean, they had the Hanford pile, they had the submarines eventually. Those were nowhere near economical in terms of power generation. So the focus of the commercial industry has always 100% been laser focused on the economics. And to sort of come in and say, oh, let's focus on economics now, is basically insulting. And anyway, I think it comes from a place of ignorance. And so that's why I'm always like, hey, look at this, you know, enriched lithium cooled NAC reactor from 1965, you know, and people are like, oh, wait a minute, that's actually interesting. Right, so there's, right. Anyway, that's a little bit
definitely
more about my baseline.
People joke about sort of back to the future reactors, that a lot of these concepts were tried out in this kind of, again, heyday of innovation. It seems like a lot of the rhetoric around some of the advanced designs is, you know, it infers that existing nuclear is not good enough, and we're going to solve all these problems. We're going to make nuclear proliferation proof. We're going to make waste a non-issue. You know, we're going to make a reactor that's so passively safe that, you know, a monkey can run it. So it's really sort of building off this concept that things aren't good enough, or that this technology is almost like fatally flawed, and maybe there's a way to innovate all of its problems away. And I think a focus of a lot of advocates, myself included, is to say, I mean, every technology comes with some baggage and some issues that need to be solved. But with nuclear, because of the association with weapons, these issues are blown up into, you know, just to such a degree of hyperbole that it can sort of lead the engineers in the wrong direction in terms of maybe focusing more on economics. We're chasing these unsolvable you know, apocalyptic problems of something like waste, for instance.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a tough balance. It's very complicated, but there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. There are parts of light water reactor fleets that are not totally optimal, and it is certainly technically possible and probably actually possible to do better in certain areas, and that is interesting and intriguing. But you know, there's an issue where, yes, as you're saying, if you say, well, light water reactors aren't safe enough, and so you need something safer, well, that's basically an anti-nuclear talking point. You know, or if, you know, waste is such a huge problem that you need to cut the volume of waste by maybe half by using a higher burn-up reactor, well, that's sort of admitting that, well, the current waste that we have is an unsolvable problem. And so those can be counterproductive. And so, yeah, I sort of wish what we had is I wish the industry was more focused on deploying the technology that we have already good to go, fully licensed, full supply chain, ready to build. And then there was, you know, the profits from that industry ideally would be funding advancements and running ahead on trying to improve the fuel, improve the safety case, and so on incrementally. And that would be sort of ideal. But what we're seeing now is that there's sort of two separate industries. There's the fleet, and there's the advanced nuclear startup companies that are basically completely separated from each other in a sense.
Mm-hmm. What you're describing sounds a bit like, you know, situation with Russia and its, you know, sodium fast reactor fleet, or China and dipping into high temperature gas reactors and molten salt reactors as these kind of side projects. And that seems sensible. But why don't we actually start doing some history lessons here? And, you know, I threw out a few of those dates. And again, they're completely astounding to me, particularly when you compare them to fusion and sort of like the first human induced fusion and sort of where we're at now in terms of energy and energy out. But yeah, let's just take us through a little bit of that early history, and I'm sure we'll kind of veer off course into all kinds of awesome tangents, and that's A-okay.
Okay, yeah, just direct me, because there's a lot. And yeah, I usually have my archives to go off, so my memory isn't photographic, but I'll do my best. So, okay, where do we start? So you mentioned, well, fusion. I mean, there were fusion reactions discovered in the mid-30s or early 30s, where we knew that in an accelerator, we could fuse two nuclei and create a totally different atom. And it made a huge amount of energy. It was recognized very early on that there's a bunch of energy in atoms, but no one knew how to get it out. And people thought... people spent a lot of time even back then trying to figure out and inventing ways to try to fuse nuclei in a way that could potentially release energy. It was impossible. It seemed impossible. There was no way to do it eventually neutrons were discovered, and then fission was discovered in 1938. And this was very interesting because with just a little low energy neutron, it's not a huge particle accelerator. It's just a little floating neutron comes along and goes into a uranium atom, and it just unlocks this huge amount of energy instantly without any, it just opens right up. And that became, so that's a miracle in itself that there's so much energy in the atom. And then the other miracle is that it releases 2 to 3 extra neutrons, which then can be used in a chain reaction. And so all of a sudden, everyone immediately realized there's this actually practical potential way to unlock vast amounts of the energy in the nucleus. And of course, because of the context, it was the World Wars. I mean, the conflict in Europe was coming up. This was turned into a weapon first. Well, it was... effort was focused on a weapon first, and along the way, Fermi indeed did demonstrate that you could get a chain reacting nuclear reaction in as you said, December 2nd, 1942. That's a famous date, as we'll come back to.
So we obviously don't have time to like deep dive the Manhattan Project. Yeah. And I've got a Manhattan Project expert we're going to talk to shortly, but just
yeah, I won't.
Let's talk about. Yeah, I mean, I want to answer this question of how we get from Meitner to let's just say the Nautilus. Let's just say PWR, right. Freaking submarine.
Well, I'll
jump in a little bit.
Just a little bit on the Manhattan Project. So they had to make very pure graphite in order to go critical. And so there's this huge supply chain. They had to work with industry to make vast amounts of very pure graphite. There was a boron impurity that would prevent the chain reaction. So it became, there was this establishment between nuclear standards. Purity standards are extremely, sort of unbelievably high. It was less than a part per million of boron required. So there was an establishment of nuclear people and industry working together to establish obscenely ridiculous specifications. And then, okay, let's fast forward. 1944, Hanford piles are up and running. Those guys then did the world's first reactor innovation sessions. They had a whole year where they sat around and came up with every crazy reactor you can imagine. Basically, every reactor you've ever heard of has been published in 1944 in this thing they called the New Piles Committee. It was just like a bunch of scientists and applied physicists kind of playing around.
So most people are familiar with the Fermi pile, just a whole bunch of graphite. And I mean, can you describe it quickly? And then just the Hanford pile, is that similar or different? Then
we'll talk a bit about Hanford. Yeah. So they, yes, it's, they, I won't go into it, but they found out that if you separate your fuel, they had sort of spheres or cylinders of fuel. And they found out that if you separate that fuel from blocks of graphite, there's this huge neutronic advantage. Basically, the neutrons can slow down in peace in the moderator, avoiding absorption in the uranium, and then come back to cause a fission. It turns out it's more likely to cause a fission if it's a slow neutron in natural uranium than a fast neutron. So it's just a bunch of, like, imagine just a bunch of spheres and about this big of uranium in graphite blocks, maybe this big in this big lattice. It was, you know, it was a squash court filled with little interspersed 3D grid of fuel and graphite blocks. And it had no cooling channels. It was very low power. They couldn't run it more than half a watt because the shielding requirements would dose the people around it to at a dangerous level. So they ran it at half a watt and did a little bit of study. And then that evolved to the Hanford pile which was very similar, but they needed it to be much higher power because the rate of plutonium production is proportional to how fast you're splitting atoms. And if you're splitting atoms faster, that makes a bunch of extra heat. They didn't want the heat. If they were making plutonium, they just want plutonium, but they have to move the heat somehow. And so they decided the absolutely easiest way to do it. There was a big debate between helium coolant, which they thought they needed, and water coolant. And they decided, Wigner decided it was possible to go critical with water, with natural uranium. And so it's a graphite thing, but instead of 3D spacing of fuel, they had tubes of fuel and they flowed water from the river. It was actually direct once through cooling. So like water came from the river, went through the core, and then went right back out to the river. There was no heat exchanger or anything. Anyway, and that thing, and then you could slide the slugs of fuel through the cylinders and they would pop out the back into a giant vat, which they would then do chemistry on and pull the plutonium out.
Sounds like a can-do.
Yeah. A little bit. There's something similar. Yeah.
Right. So these Hanford piles were plutonium production reactors.
Yes. And yeah. They were the first high power reactors with actual cooling. Well, there was an air cooled mini reactor at Oak Ridge called X10. But yes, they were plutonium production reactors. They were pretty low temperature. They didn't make steam that would be useful for making electricity. They had aluminum cladding that couldn't go to very high temperature without corroding and so on. So yes, they were just for making plutonium, but they were pretty big. They were 200 megawatts and they made three of them right in a row.
And so you're saying that all sorts of conversations happened around this.
So then the conversation turns like, okay, we're making plutonium for weapons. That's horrible. How can we do something good for civilization with this technology? And that's when the conversation turned to like, how should we make economical electric power? What can we do to make how can we compete with fossil fuel? And that's where all these crazy ideas started coming in. And they had reactors where with gaseous uranium coolant that would compress with a piston and then, like a reciprocating engine. They had a bunch of heavy water reactors where pistons would slide the slurry of fuel from one side to another, going through a reflector region, which would go critical and then cause power to come out. I mean, the craziness level and sort of the ingenuity, it was just astounding. But eventually, people were like, all right, let's get serious. What's actually going to work? And there was this big moment when there was a realization that a water-cooled, water-moderated reactor could actually be neutronically interesting. This is sort of an interesting story. I don't know if you want to go into it. But when at first they thought water in a lattice of fuel was nowhere near, it was 0.9 needing 1.0 on K infinity for natural uranium. But there was an effect that they totally missed out, which is that if you bring the fuel close together, fast neutrons can go from one pin to another and cause a fission in the neighboring pin. This effect doesn't happen in graphite because the fast neutrons rarely make it to another piece of fuel. But in a really tight lattice, now you have a fast fission effect. And that brought K infinity of a natural uranium water-cooled, water-moderated reactor almost to one. Like, it was so close to one that it became interesting. And so people like Alvin Weinberg were like, wait a minute, regular water in a very much more compact core with just regular water as both the coolant and the moderator is super convenient. I mean, that's, everybody knows water. We have water equipment. It's very compact. What an interesting potential concept. And so he started promoting that. And of course, eventually the Navy got interested in that. And he met and worked with Admiral or Captain Rickover at the time. Anyway, Rickover, whatever his rank was in 1946. And that's when we really started kicking off the development of the first naval power reactor. However, even then, it was thought, there was no one thought that the water-cooled, water-moderated reactor would be economical at all. And there was, when people said, well, let's try to commercialize a water reactor, there was huge pushback against it because it was thought, because it's so inefficient with uranium, it's not a breeder. It only burns 0.5% of the natural uranium. And right. At the time, they thought uranium was extremely scarce. And so the absolute focus was on breeder reactors. That's why EBR-1 was the first electricity producing reactor. They built a breeder back then because they thought the only way to have commercial power would be to use breeders because the fuel costs would just be too ridiculously high for everything else.
And
so
I guess you could justify like a naval nuclear propulsion on the, even in a world of constrained uranium because of just the incredible advantages that a nuclear powered submarine gives you. So even if it's uneconomical, we can divert it for a strategic benefit. Is that maybe the rationale? Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. You don't care about competing with coal in a submarine because you have the nuclear advantage of not needing oxygen and having, decades of fuel inside. One thing makes it for the first time ever a true submersible. And they went on these great adventures around the world under, submerged in one trip and up to the North Pole and so on. And that's only made possible because of the technical advantages of using nuclear power in a submarine. And so the cost doesn't matter. And also you're never going to, even if you're extremely inefficient with uranium, it doesn't matter because you're not powering the world with submarines. You're just making a couple hundred max to defend yourself or whatever. So
So again, what's special about this environment? I imagine innovation benefits from having, I'm not sure what percentage of GDP was going into the Manhattan Project, for instance, or these Hanford piles, but obviously, flows of cash, good. Flows of cash, good. And then, as I understand it, we've sort of moved through eras, right? We had sort of the chemistry era preceding this in which, a lot of great discoveries were made, I think mostly, many in Germany, for instance, a number of different processes, Fischer-Tropsch, Haber-Bosch, et cetera, all kinds of dyes and medicines and things like that. We move into this kind of age of physics and we've kind of proceeded in, I guess, more recently into an age of biotechnology and, decoding the human genome and on into software. So is that like another element, I guess, is just the human resources. This is kind of where it's at. This is the exciting area. If you're really, really smart, you're going to go into this area. But what else are, like, if you had to sort of come up with like three or four reasons why all this innovation happened, what would they be?
Okay, let's see. So yeah, great point. And that's absolutely that eye of Sauron of innovation was on nuclear at that time. So what are the things? So national imperative is one thing. I mean, do this by any means or be destroyed by the Nazis is a pretty good motivator. And that built up a lot of alignment and sort of brought in very centrally controlled, nobody knew what the other person was doing type Manhattan Project stuff. And it was an unbelievably huge expense, an incredible achievement. And so that was, that really is a first thing that laid the groundwork that had lots of people trained up, lots of industries scaled up. And then boom, hey world, we have created or discovered an absolute new, we have a secret weapon that no one's ever heard of. I mean, it's straight out of science fiction. Our scientists went and unlocked a fundamental power of the universe and it's going to change everything. And everybody, every comic book, every high school mascot was nuclear related in the early 50s. And it was extremely interesting. Everybody poured into it. Popular Science had dozens of articles about, nuclear power this, nuclear power that. The Jetsons future was here and everybody and went into it. And then the government kept pouring more and more money in, originally for Cold War reasons, ramping up weapons capability, building more reactors for weapons, and then building the submarine system. That was another huge industry that, was a government imperative. And so that just built up this massive infrastructure, huge industries. There's quotes from Rickover in Congress where he's saying, they're like, well, are you having trouble finding material? And he says, like, fuel? And they say, no, not just that, but like zirconium. And he's like, we built an industry of zirconium. I mean, they had to go out and make, there were, you know, super pure zirconium, which, again, it's high temperature, corrosion resistant, low neutron absorbing material. So they built, by government imperative for military reasons, an entire supply chain. And then everybody was super excited about it. Everybody went into it, as you're saying, and everybody wanted to be the one who brought forth this world-changing energy source that was going to bring forth a high energy future and all the sci-fi things that come with that. So, I mean, we can't understate how important those like two or three government programs in a row were. I mean, Manhattan Project, Cold War weapons complex, and submarine propulsion, not to mention Army reactors and Air Force reactors, which are also huge programs. So, I mean, there's just unbelievable injection of public money into it, and then a bunch of people who really wanted to turn it into something that would be beneficial for civilian purposes as well. That's what happened then. Whether or not that's required or essential for continued innovation now is a little bit, it shouldn't be. I mean, it would be great to get more people excited and into it. And that is happening. I will say, like, with the nuclear startup thing, it's become cool again to work in nuclear. Certainly fusion has always been cool, but now there's money coming in from private sources, billionaires effectively, who are saying, I want to change the world and I want to help out with some kind of, and now it's driven by climate concerns, energy scarcity. So let's fund all these people going in. And so now there's a bunch of cool people, you've got young folks working on cool nuclear things, both in fission and fusion. And that's kind of bringing that element of it back in a sense, but that's rushing ahead. So I can stay focused.
Yeah. I mean, something I've been reflecting upon, and it just seems like this would be a really basic thing to do, is to look around the world, who's succeeding at deploying right now. And what are the characteristics of those, you know, socioeconomic, political systems? What are those kind of ecosystems of private companies and public companies and, you know, departments of energy, et cetera? How is it all working out? And, you know, the degree to which those are replicable in the U.S., maybe in the 1960s U.S., 1970s U.S., but there's been a real transformation in terms of the idea of the role of government in the economy. And you know, I think in strategic industry, and as we've offshored a lot of heavy industry, even more so. You know, again, if you look at Russia, China, I'm thinking of Rosatom and just this vertical integration that goes all the way down. It's kind of sounds similar to what you're describing here. There's a bit of a national imperative, you know, I mean, the weapons thing is obviously still there, but also we want to export nuclear reactors. We want to do it efficiently. We want to be the number one in the world on that. We're going to make sure that we've got everything in terms of the whole fuel cycle, the waste management, the reactors on deck, and we can sell them around the world. With that objective in mind, and that kind of like singular focus, you can see that might be pretty efficient, despite claims that, you know, state ownership or stewardship of a process by definition makes it ineffective or uninnovative. I'm not sure what your thoughts are there.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, if you look around the world and see who's doing well, they're all vertically integrated, state-owned organizations. Even in Korea, I mean, it's utility and vendor combined. You know, KEPCO is sort of they design it, construct it, sometimes operate it. And that's how it was in France. That's how and that's how it certainly is in China and Russia. And so that certainly it works and is working right now. But there's with the democratic Western nations, it's just not the style of operation that people want to run huge projects in, unless there's some, except, you know, if there's a Manhattan Project or an Apollo Project or something. Right. So it's like we sometimes choose to focus on that. But I think there's enough controversy around nuclear. I mean, it's had a whole history and plenty of baggage and so on, that now there isn't a unified national alignment with no opposition or minimal opposition that says, yeah, let's just do sort of a centrally planned nuclear deployment. Let's pick a standard technology that we know works and build back up that supply chain and start trying to deploy them and compete with these state-owned actors who are exporting VVERs to Nigeria and so on at extremely low cost. Like, that's hard to compete with.
What do you think about this? Because I'm trying to red team my ideas and not be too simplistic, right? And so, you know, and I've heard pushback that, hey, no, the U.S. bucked this trend. They didn't have a France-like deployment, which, again, that's not communism. That's, again, I think the term, and it sounds horrible in English, is dirigisme, but like basically, or dirigiste, like a role of the state directing things. And again, that was, not a Manhattan Project, but it was a response to a major energy crisis where they had no gas, they had no coal, they were burning oil, and the price of oil went up. And so there was a real strategic energy security imperative to get something going fast to underpin your entire power generation system. So one can see the West is capable of going, hey, there's a role for the state here when it's a national security or national energy security motivation. But in the US, you know, the historic deployment, 60s, 70s, and 80s, that wasn't some big state-led project, as far as I understand. But what do you think about this idea that a utility is kind of like a state? You know, if it's a large enough utility, it has a huge rate base, that's kind of like having a tax base. You know, that there's some similarities anyway in terms of even a big private U.S. utility in a regulated market.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough call. I mean, first of all, not to jump on this, but there was a massive, I mean, the program by which light water reactors were commercialized in the United States was driven by a cooperative government program called the Power Demonstration Reactor Project. And it was a huge project that developed all sorts of different kind of reactors. And it just turns out that the light water reactors outperform dozens of other types of non-light water reactors. And we can talk about that.
Let's do that.
Okay. So it's early 1950s. The UK has Calderhall. They're building a big power plant with a gas-cooled reactor. Soviets have just announced that they've got a little 5-megawatt reactor on the grid. And the US Congress is like, we are falling behind the other countries. We need to develop nuclear power because Cold War, because we're going to fall behind technologically, and whoever develops this is going to have a huge advantage and so on. So there's this big interest across the board of developing economical nuclear power. And so the Atomic Energy Commission created, with congressional support, something called the Power Demonstration Reactor Project. It was a reactor project for power demonstration. And they put out three rounds of sort of request for bid. And they said, hey, who of you out there would like government assistance developing a reactor that's going to maybe compete with coal economically? Coal was the only competition at the time, really. And so what happened was consortiums of utilities came out and they paired up with like a reactor vendor. So maybe you get like 12 utilities partner up with Atomics International, and they put together a proposal and they sent it to the Atomic Energy Commission. It says, we're going to build a low pressure, sodium cooled, graphite moderated, high temperature reactor that's going to be super, have high thermal efficiency, use almost no uranium at all, uses 1% enriched uranium, and it has a high likelihood of achieving commercial parity. And then the AEC would look at it and be like, yeah, okay, we agree. They had criteria. Is it likely to offset coal? How much is it going to cost us? And how mature is the technology already based on previous reactor experiments? And so a bunch of reactors came through and the Atomic Energy Commission approved lots of them. And they would say, okay, we will. At the time, only the Atomic Energy Commission could own fuel. So what they did is they would lease fuel to the utility and then charge them for usage of that fuel. So like, and they would take the fuel back and reprocess it. And they reprocessed pretty much everything because it was so rare at the time. And so they said, okay, we'll waive your fuel usage charges. We'll waive your heavy water charges. We will subsidize a bunch of R&D related to it, but you will finance the design, the construction, operation, owning the facility. And so it was kind of a lot of them came in. The utility consortium would pay $30 million. Atomic Energy Commission would pay $5 million or something like that. It's all over the place, but there's a big variety of that. And people came in with, like I said, sodium graphite reactors, Fermi 1 sodium cooled fast breeder reactor was 26 utilities who had come together to do that. They form a corporation. But there was more government support with that one, with more R&D. So the government was providing lots of R&D and the fuel charges. But it was by and large, in that first round, it was by and large coming from these big risk diversified consortia of utilities. Well, then small utilities weren't getting involved and Congress was told to do it. I mean, they wanted to have it go out in rural America too. And so, but none of the small utilities could finance or build or operate their own reactor. And so they did a round two. And in round two of the Power Demonstration Reactor Project program, the AEC would build, own, and operate the nuclear side of it. The utility would build, own, and operate the turbine and power conversion and provide the site and the land and all the wires and so on. And then the AEC would run the plant for 5 years and then sell it to the utility if the utility wanted it, or the utility could just decline it, at which point the AEC was mandated to to tear down the reactor. And so there's lots of examples. So, and that history is just littered with reactors that the utility was like, nah, like, I don't want it. So like Hallam.
Okay, give us some examples.
Hallam, my favorite reactor, was in Nebraska. It's the sodium cooled graphite moderated reactor. Really genius idea. It was, it's elegant. I mean, I agree that it's like highly likely to be super economical. So it's not a sodium cooled fast reactor. It's a sodium cooled slow reactor because it has graphite blocks in it. And again, that gives you all the high temperature, low pressure advantages of sodium coolant, but you only need like 1 or 2% enriched uranium instead of HALEU or plutonium or whatever. But it was early in the sodium world, and the sodium and the graphite moderator cans leaked, and sodium came in and it swelled. And so they had operational challenges. It just wasn't operating effectively, even though the concept was brilliant. And on paper, it was absolutely mind blowing. But the thing didn't operate well. It could have been fixed, but by the time it came for the utility to choose to buy it in Nebraska, they were just like, nah, we don't want it. They had actually built a coal plant that fed into the same exact turbine because that high temperature machine was compatible with the steam from a coal plant. So it was literally, it was a nuclear plant on one side, coal plant on the other side, and one turbine. And the coal plant fed it whenever the nuclear plant was down. And since the coal plant was feeding it so much, they were like, forget it. We don't care about that. So now that coal plant is still in operation. And the nuclear plant, you can look at the satellite pictures, like green field where the nuclear plant was, turbine, coal plant, and a big mile long coal train. But anyway, another example is Pequa. Pequa is a small town in Ohio, and the city of Pequa, this little tiny town, put in a proposal that said, we want an organic cooled, organic moderated reactor. This is using like some kind of
a hippie
oil
reactor.
Yeah, the organic. But it's like it's called terphenyl. It's like an oil type of mineral oil type of coolant, which has a lot of, again, high temperature, low pressure. That thing, but the problem, it has radiation instability. So radiation sort of breaks the organic chains, and it turns into tar and gunks up everything. And so that reactor, similarly, they built it. They operated it for had problems. They said they could fix it. They probably could have fixed it, but the utility was like, hell no, get that thing out of my face. And they shut it down. And anyway, what others? There was Peach Bottom high temperature gas cooled reactor was in that program. A couple superheat BWRs, Bonus in Puerto Rico was part of that program. There were Fermi 1 obviously had operational troubles with the core melt and other just operational issues. It just was a premature time for sodium cooled reactors back then. That was way back. And so again and again and again, these advanced quote unquote non-water reactors were just hard to operate. Even though they were awesome on paper, they didn't perform. And so people shut them down. You know what did perform was the regular water cool. The PWRs and BWRs performed beautifully. I mean, they had a couple problems, but compared to the non-water systems, they were like awesome. And so everybody was like, as good as, even though they aren't that efficient with their uranium, well, it looks like there's a lot more uranium than we thought. And so maybe that issue isn't so much a pressing concern. We found tons of uranium in the West. Everybody, you know, there's an I Love Lucy in the 50s where they go out uranium hunting. Like it was that big of a deal. Like everybody's out finding uranium. And so it's like, well, okay, if we don't care that much about uranium efficiency right now, and these reactors are operating extremely reliably and they're relatively easy to run, then let's just build those. And so you have this graph. I made a little plot of the reactors, and you can see just a couple years, couple years, couple years, couple years. And then there's a bunch that go out into the 90s of these little tiny 50 and so megawatt PWRs and BWRs. And that's what happened. Like, that's why utilities chose PWRs and BWRs over all the other higher performance reactors, higher performance on paper, that were just too difficult to operate. They didn't operate well. And that's really why we have PWRs and BWRs today.
Is that what like Rickover's famous paper reactor letter was describing, or how do you interpret that? When was it written? What was it? Yeah, what was the context in which he wrote that?
That's something I've wondered. So that was So that letter was written in 1953, whereas this program was happening from like 55 to 65 or 70. So that letter was from before this program. So I've wondered, like, how the hell did Rickover know to write the paper reactor memo in 1953? I mean, how many reactors were there? Well, I think I have a lead on it at this point. So when he went to he went to Oak Ridge. He was sent to Oak Ridge to learn about nuclear technology right after World War II with a group of six Navy officers. And he was sat there with Alvin Weinberg and all these scientists at what became ORSORT. It's the prototype of any nuclear reactor or nuclear engineering university program. They had it at Oak Ridge to begin with. And they went and they spent a lot of time designing kind of goofy reactors. They had like a senior design project almost. And so, but their big focus in 1946 was this thing called the Daniels pile. It was a pebble bed, high temperature gas cooled reactor developed by a guy named Farrington Daniels a couple years earlier in like 1944. And it was, it's basically exactly a pebble bed reactor, helium cooled, TRISO-like pebbles. And Rickover was looking at it, and the scientists were like, look at it, it's beautiful, it's high efficiency, high temperature, and so on. And Rickover was like kind of staring at it, and he started asking questions. He had an extremely mature engineering background at this point, and we can rewind on his history in a second. But I mean, he's been in the engine room of ships for decades, and he knows like how equipment works on ships and ship environments. And he starts asking about helium leakage, radiated helium. What happens if the gas leaks? How do you stop it? How do you repair it? What happens if this breaks? What's the maintenance look like? And he quickly realized that reactor was just a crazy idea, had no basis in reality. And so he told, at the time, which isn't totally true, it was developed later and works fine-ish. But at the time, he was like, this is not what we want for submarines. Like, this is not anywhere. So he got his Navy people to stop working on that thing and just sort of study and learn and ask questions. And that's where he talked to Weinberg and eventually went with. He didn't know if he wanted water at first. He had to choose between, he did have two candidate coolants. It was water and sodium. And they built a water-cooled submarine, and they built a sodium-cooled submarine. Those are the first sort of two big projects. And it turns out, but that was after the memo. So, in 1953, he must have been referring to like the scientists at ORSORT, because he wrote in his later memoirs and his writings on this that he's like, he lost trust in scientists at that point. He knew scientists were nice and he knew they had a lot to say, but he realized that they did not understand the practicalities of maintenance, operation, reliability, quality. And so he shifted in his thought. And I'm pretty sure that memo was written based on discussions from ORSORT and the following couple years where people came out with reactor ideas, because they did. You can find that some of the great reactor designs come out of those early publications where they have like design studies. That's where, like, again, if it wasn't in the 1944, it was coming out of Oak Ridge, that school in the late 40s, basically, molten salt reactors and so on.
Right. God, I've got so many questions spinning in my head. Out of those questions, one thing I think James Kralenstein brought this up when sort of talking about the relative performance of the water moderated water cooled reactors, and basically was saying, listen, like, since the Industrial Revolution, we've got 250-ish years of managing, you know, pressure vessels and high temperature steam. You know, we've had a chance to troubleshoot that for hundreds of years, and we just haven't had that with you know, the molten salts or with you know, liquid sodium or high temperature gas reactors. Is that sort of a similar read, that we just need more time to troubleshoot some of the peculiarities of the technology? Or are there, you know, is there a, and that, you know, a larger stream of experience that I'm not aware of, using molten salts in some other way, or using sodium as a coolant? Is this just particularities to nuclear? Or
I certainly don't think we will never develop a fully reliable sodium or molten salt or gas cooled system. I mean, there's nothing inherent about the physics that would prevent that from being possible. And indeed, I've worked on those kind of things for years, thinking that it will be meaningful and helpful. So, I think it certainly is just a matter of finding an environment where you can shake it down long enough in sort of fleet mode, not on paper, not in a small experiment, but like in fleet mode, to be able to really work through the problems in a way that doesn't kill you from the valley of death in terms of like, oops, that was supposed to be fully commercialized and it's not competing with natural gas right now, and so let's shut it down. Like, it's too hard to get that prototype going and then have some problem that's going to cost the price of the prototype to fix. And everyone's just like, nah, I'm not going to do it. So how do you get over that? I don't really know. And there are some inherent, well, there's pros and cons of all the coolants, but I mean, there's things like sodium activates and becomes thousands of times more radioactive than water. And so in a submarine environment, you have this much larger source term just from the activated coolant that you have to shield than water. And so in certain environments, I mean, that's challenging. Like, there's no way, there's no magical shielding material. Like, you have to put in more shielding to deal with highly activated coolant. So if you're, so that, those kind of things. And Rick Overall will tell stories about when they had the Seawolf and they parked it next to, you know, a water-cooled reactor. The people in the water-cooled reactor were getting more dose from the activated sodium. And so it's just like that. That's sort of an inherent problem. But that's specific to a submarine. You can build as much shielding as you want around a commercial power plant. So, yes, there's no reason that it's certainly possible to make a well-operating molten salt gas-cooled or sodium.
You said there's no, like, the physics, you know, there's no kind of physics-based reason, but is there, like, an engineering-based reason? And like, I like that dichotomy of Rickover as this experienced mechanical engineer going to, I forget that, Oroft or whatever, and saying, oh, these scientists, right? And it reminds me a little bit of fusion, where it's like, you know, it's an incredible science project, but, you know, a lot of these machines are just, you know, like tokamaks, they're just trying to eat themselves. Like, there are these machines that are trying to destroy themselves. So is there, are they just harder from an engineering perspective, or,
well,
or just more troubleshooting is required?
Yeah, they're absolutely harder from an engineering perspective. I mean, all the coolants we're talking about, in terms of maintenance, it's harder to go in and maintain a coolant if you get in there, like, humans need air to survive, but if sodium interacts with air, you know, it has a combustion reaction. And so maintenance is more challenging. It's just actually more challenging. Same with molten salt. If you have a molten salt that's either activated or has fuel in it and you want to go chop up a pipe and replace it, well, it's easy in a water-cooled reactor. You drain the water and put a new person and weld it. But try doing that in, like, an extremely radioactive environment. It is technically more challenging. And so, but there's advantages. I mean, you can have these massive performance increases if you do it. So there's it's a tantalizing goal and there's potential there. But yes, the actual, when you focus on reliability, maintainability, those things are extremely challenging and require a lot of work. And it's not like, you can't just build one of them and think it's a sure thing. You have to get into fleet mode to really understand the overall reliability. So it's really hard to jump into that.
Often I'll hear, like, well, EBR2 proved that, you know, this, you know, my reactor concept is fine and ready for commercial operations, or the molten salt reactor experiment proves that this is a mature technology and it's ready for deployment. And I can see you kind of chuckling, but, you know, and the Russians have had a sodium fast reactor program going, I think, for like nigh on 40 years at this point.
Yeah, more than that.
Completely misinformed.
BR5 or whatever. Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by this idea of just reactor years of operation. So from what I understand, like, the water-cooled, water-moderated systems have something like 17 or 18,000 years of reactor years of operation in which to troubleshoot and learn. What's your sense of those numbers for molten salt reactors or sodium fast reactors or gas?
I know it for sodium.
High-temperature gas reactors.
I know the number for sodium fast reactors is around 450 reactor years or so. Lots of countries have built lots of sodium-cooled reactors, most of them fast reactors. Only a few of these sodium-cooled slow reactors have operated. But yeah, so it's like 450 or something like that is in sodium. For molten salt, I mean, it's like four. It's like all molten salt reactor experiment. Yeah. There's the aircraft reactor experiment, which ran before that. That was a molten salt reactor. It ran for about 4 days. So that one doesn't add too many years. And then actually China has completed a thorium molten salt reactor experiment, very similar to MSRE. And that's been licensed to turn on. I'm waiting for that thing to turn on any moment. So they'll fire that thing up and they'll get more information similar to what MSRE was providing and hopefully advance the state of knowledge. I'm sure they will. I'm glad they started it up or they built it. But so anyway, that'll go from 4 to 10, hopefully soon. Gas cooled reactors, there's lots more experience. Germany had a couple up and running, or at least one, AVR. Anyway, I'm slightly rusty there. And we had Peach Bottom, we had Fort St. Vrain, which were big reactors. And we had a couple little small reactor experiments along those lines as well. So, but anyway, it's not much. It's a lot less than sodium. Sodium's like the second most mature or experienced technology. And as you say, like, the Russians have done it continuously since the 50s or 60s. And they're in a situation where they never shut down their sodium program. They've been running the only commercial sodium cooled fast reactors, and they're still building PWR, VVERs. And in fact, they've said things like, well, we can't quite get our sodium cooled reactors to economically compete with our own pressurized water reactors. And so, but they have certain advantages in terms of transmuting waste and breeding fuel and so on, that we think we're going to have like a few of these sodium cooled reactors providing fuel cycle services to a big fleet of PWRs. And that's kind of a traditional fuel cycle idea that lots of big national nuclear planning organizations will show these days. So, but they, I mean, even after all that experience, they're kind of saying like, well, it's, we're still struggling. Maybe we can get economically competitive when we go bigger to the BN-1200. But it just goes to show
not small that, modular, but large, yeah, large, large.
They're going large. Right. They think that's what they need to do. But then they're also saying, well, maybe, you know, let's try this lead cooled thing. And so they're doing lead cooled reactors as well, just because maybe they're concerned that they're hitting some kind of wall in terms of economic performance with their sodium systems. So you could argue that, like, okay, maybe sodium is not as economic, so let's try something else. No one's gotten even close to that level of experience with something like a molten salt reactor. We just don't know. We've certainly proven that you can run a heat generating molten salt reactor with MSRE, but we haven't proven that you can build a reliable, well operated power plant. That is completely unknown. It should be doable, but someone has to prove it. And the utilities are very conservative, and they want it to be proven before they go build a bunch of them.
So with all this in mind, why, I mean, I'll forgive Andrew Yang, U.S. presidential candidate, who basically just molten salt thorium reactors are going to save the world. But in terms of, you know, people that I think are and maybe should be better informed, and I'm trying to be very diplomatic here. I probably already put my foot in my mouth. But like, why is the gestalt in the U.S. right now around, like, what the way I'm trying to explain it is, well, there's this great pride, as there should be, in the development of the PWR and BWR. America's been the foremost sort of origin of nuclear reactor technology development, and we can't deploy, so we'll just cling to that pride and say, hey, we're the most innovative, we're generating lots of cool new concepts. But like, the whole focus seems to be in terms of again, this I'm calling it gestalt, that might not be the best word, right, but in terms of the overall environment and what's being talked about in the US, you know, I think it's very advanced, HALEU, et cetera, focused. Is that just because of not paying attention to history and to, you know, for instance, what's been happening in Russia and having this PWR fleet as the basis and running some experiments on the side? And
what's
your take culturally
culturally what's happening? My take on this, my opinion from what I've seen or talked to people about, is that, yeah, there are people who are coming in saying, hey, nuclear should be good, but nuclear has a bad rap. And so I am going to do, as I was saying earlier, I'm just going to do something so much better because I'm so much more innovative than those people in the past. And I have this phrase, it's like, those guys were idiots. Like, the people, these hundreds of thousands of people in old nuclear, like, didn't know about economics, or they didn't think about manufacturing, which there is an arrogance that's just wrong. It's just misinformed, or they think those people weren't innovative enough, and now I, the big genius that I am going to come in and push out something that just blows away the performance of the people in the past. And I think they truly believe that. And that's one of the reasons I like, again, to dwell on nuclear history, to show how exotic and sophisticated and economically focused people were, not really just to prove the point that there's lots to be learned, and the knowledge level starts very low, and the troubles that you run into are not obvious at first. And just running an MCMP model of a core that goes critical and runs for a couple of years means nothing at all. I mean, you might as well, I mean, you haven't even started. You have to really do so much more than that. And so it's just a lack of sophistication, a lack of knowledge of the history, and an arrogance that makes people think that they're just going to swoop in here with a team of three people and pound out a revolutionary nuclear technology. Now, there's also the idea that large light water reactors in the US are just stalled out, like no utility is ever going to buy another one, that people say. I don't think that's true, and I hope that's not true. And I wish more people were focused on innovating around how to deploy more reactors that we already have. I mean, if we want to decarbonize rapidly, we should focus most of the effort on rapidly deploying known technology and a little bit of the effort on what's the next thing once we sort of have that big problem solved. That would be sort of my ideal. But it reflects the nation's focus. I mean, the people in general don't know a thing about nuclear history, obviously. Like, who knows about it? Just a bunch of... and they feel like old nuclear is, like, old and bad. And so when it turns out that part of civilization who has lots of money and wants to invest that money in helping in the energy world, they think, well, the right thing to do would be advanced nuclear, as opposed to no one wants to get in there and like help make the light water reactors more efficient or like deploy the next light water reactor in a way that's bring in the South Koreans to build an APR 1400 right. In the US. That would be an awesome startup company. I wish somebody made that startup company, but that's just not what
In my humble experience, which is very little, but also being based up here in Ontario, where I think there is some credibility with an organization like OPG doing these kind of refurbishments, which are not building a new reactor, but it's very complex work. Tons of, the critical path is insane. So many inputs, so many opportunities for things to go wrong and pulling it off. And that's not sexy, or it's not really giving you a VC type return. But that kind of institutional excellence seems to be what ultimately makes nuclear deployable, and at least the capital expense part economical. And hey, the operating expense as well. You need that kind of institutional excellence and whatnot. And I think it's far easier to kind of get wedded and imagine ideas like, well, some guys in a lab, doing some computer sims are going to make this huge breakthrough. And frankly, I think like a lot of that money that's coming into nuclear from the VC side is coming out of Silicon Valley and have had miracles of disruption in terms of technology components, software. And so it's totally natural that, they would see nuclear, be techno optimists, want to make some money, but also want to, save the world and sort of see this frustratingly slow moving technology and say, hey, can we disrupt this somehow? I totally get that impulse.
Yeah. I'm like really conflicted because part of me is like, thank goodness somebody is like getting excited about nuclear and pouring money in and developing young new people and learning all sorts of cool stuff. Like, this is great. This is an absolutely good thing. And then the other part of me is like, the overall likelihood of disrupting through this approach may be lower than people expect. So I don't know. I'm certainly conflicted about it. I don't have all the answers to sort of solving that issue. So yeah, I sort of feel like let's just change the proportions. Like, more people focus on LWR deployment and focus, and maybe we can just grow the pie in general. But let's try to get a little bit more focus on that known technology and a little bit less over obsession with like the brilliant innovator who swoops in and saves everything. Like, I think we're a little bit obsessed with that concept, or the concept of innovation. When, I mean, Rickover built the entire nuclear industry, not just submarines, but he then through Shippingport built the commercial nuclear industry as well. And he did it through basically what can only be described as like extremely hard work, ridiculous specifications, and kind of like being very grumpy and angering a lot of people. And it shouldn't have to be that way. That's not the only way to do it. But it is true that that's what made reliable reactors. I mean, it wasn't just crazy fun, interesting ideas. It was extremely hard work, detailed specifications, and careful testing, and a lot of money.
I think this archetype of like, you need the brilliant zany scientist to come up with cool concepts, and then you need like a engineer who's worked on a god awful number of naval vessels and played around with diesel engines in them and troubleshot and done all kinds of maintenance to kind of fuse together to deliver here. And that's a metaphor that probably would be useful to.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because, yeah, we have the tech geniuses these days that are in that. But then, I mean, Rickover is kind of like that. I mean, he has this like larger-than-life personality, but he's not about... It wasn't about innovation at all. It was about like deep, extremely good project management, extremely good supply chain management. Yeah. He was kind of obsessed with like the non-sexy parts of project delivery, and that's what built nuclear. So he kind of was... He's like the Steve Jobs of supply chain development or something like that.
Right.
It is interesting. Yeah. And he was an electrical engineer and he just had so much knowledge. It was a coincidence of timing. He was just like perfectly baked right when this new technology came online.
We just came up on an hour. I'm going to float this one idea quickly, and we'll close on that. And I think we're going to have you come back to expound on some of these ideas, because it's been totally fascinating. But getting back to this innovation theme, there's this story of this German motorbike. I think it's a 1944 era motorcycle. The Soviets got their hands on the blueprint, said, hey, this is a pretty good motorbike. And until the fall of the Soviet Union, they had a factory or two teed up to produce this motorbike. And it was the same motorbike, same components that were being kicked off the production line 50 years later. But they did a lot of units. And so there's this idea, I think, that like command control, I mean, this is the most extreme form of central planning. Obviously, there's, you know, kind of maybe a social democratic mushy metal in Scandinavia or in France in the 70s. But on the extreme end of sort of command control, centrally planned economies, you know, you don't have innovation, but you can bang out lots of units of something. And generally speaking, you don't have the market signals to say, okay, stop that, or why don't you improve it or make it more fuel efficient. And in the West, you know, on the other extreme, I'm not sure, like libertarian capitalism or something, I'm not sure if that is the most innovative, but certainly you get a lot of new ideas floating around. And certainly if you look at, you know, motorcycles in the US, there's a lot of development from the 40s till the 90s over a similar time frame. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, if I don't want to say innovation is dangerous for nuclear, but, you know, it seems like the pace of it needs to be slower. If you innovate too quickly, maybe that's just because of the regulatory environment. It slows things down. It slows deployment down. So are Russia and China and South Korea and I guess Japan in its heyday and France, were they kind of beating us because they were just able to deploy big, stupid old reactors, boom, 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 serially? That's not a very inspiring story. Or you think there's some kind of like synthesis between the systems where we can deploy a lot and advance the tech?
There's a synthesis. I mean, the Koreans didn't just take the system 80 plus and just take it verbatim. Like, they improved it and they learned on it a little bit. And they did make a series of generational changes based on fleet mode operational experience. But the changes were modest and well considered, and it ended up being, they were good ideas. And that's, so you don't want to just stop innovation completely. I think if I had to choose, I would be like, let's get economical known technology expanding now. Like, let's get back on that curve where we're expanding nuclear at a rate that's compatible with what we want. And then given profits from that, let's fund as much innovation as we can using the profits of the well-operating fleet. Again, that's kind of sort of a dream that's not so easy to just will into existence, but that would definitely be ideal. There's plenty of improvements to be made, and there have been improvements. I mean, the French made improvements to their models as well. But yeah, I mean, if you have a plant that's good enough and it's running economically and you're selling a commodity, then there isn't that much motivation to jump to changing it. And again, back to Rickover, he would allow design changes, and they did iterate on submarines quite a bit for various necessities, but he was very conservative. If you wanted a change, it had to go. I mean, he certainly looked at every single change, and there was a huge bias against change. Like, if you wanted to change something that had fleet experience behind it, you better have a really good reason to do it. And you can, but you have to like really back it up. You don't just swap it out because someone published an MCMP calculation saying like, "Ooh, look, we save the planet." So it's just a big barrier to get a change is probably appropriate. Go ahead.
You said something interesting, which was operationally based innovations. And I think that's really interesting because it's like, you know, yes, you've operated a fleet now, and then that's informing you that, hey, this system could be improved, versus I think what's going on right now, which is a lot of sort of theoretical stuff around like, well, it'd be great to solve, you know, close the fuel cycle. So, and it's not, you know, based more in the real world of operation. So that's, I think, an interesting kind of distinction in innovation.
Yeah, and it's just, we do have better computers now, but yeah, there's nothing beats operation. It's just hard to, nuclear is intrinsically hard to innovate in a reactor. I mean, we could have more research reactors around or test reactors up and running, but they're expensive. They're hard to operate. They have problems. They're political footballs. We had FFTF, a beautiful test reactor, operated great out here in Washington State. And people would love to have it right now, but we shut it down in the 90s because there was no mission. It was expensive. There were a bunch of opposition. Who's paying for it, and so on. So it's just like maintaining that ability to sort of have a playground to do innovation and actually get operational experience. It's just really hard in nuclear. And so that if we could sort of get back to where it's easy to build what's called a reactor experiment, which is like a small non-power, well, may make power, but it's not like serving a utility, to really like try out that's what they used to do. They had an idea, they analyzed it on paper, they built a couple little experiments, and then they built a reactor experiment. And that reactor experiment, we built, I think, 25 of them or something like that. There's a huge number of them, most of which are pretty obscure. But that's a step that's like really important. Like, does this system work as a unit in an integrated fashion? And then you go to prototype, where you have like every system. And after that, you do demonstration, and then you go commercial. But that's a long process. That's like, no investor is getting rich off of a 30-year stair-step innovation like that, which is why most of the developments have sort of been government-funded so far. But that kind of a process, you could maybe democratic countries could look at sort of more of an open source type model. Not saying everything's publicly available, but we've collaborated as a big group on open source systems like the Linux kernel, for instance, with lots of experts doing lots of complicated technical work in a collaborative way.
Fighter jets.
Are those open source?
Well, not open source, but I'm saying like international collaboration, like, you know, the F-35, right? Like, if you have something that's big, complex, expensive, and a bunch of allies are going to use together.
Yeah.
You know, I've always talked about, like, you know, advanced nuclear needs an eater, right? Like, we need to have a, you know, let's have a molten salt, you know.
I mean, well, eater, yeah, and those are probably bad examples, because those mega projects have all ballooned out of control as well. Right. But like that kind of some innovation in collaboration techniques would be valuable, for instance. Like, that would be a good thing for innovation, as opposed to everybody coming up and being like, well, this combination of fuel, coolant, and moderator is my favorite. And so let's just, because that's like not necessarily productive. We need innovation in project management, collaboration, supply chain, and so on. Anyway.
All right, Nick, this has been super fascinating. Really high yield for me anyway. So thanks for making the time to be back, and we'll have you back shortly, because I think we were just scratching the surface there. Great chatting with you, my friend. And come to COP next time so we can hang out.
All right. Yeah. No, yeah. Thanks so much for having me on. It's a great pleasure, and take care.
All right. Bye for now.